Okay. Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is February 16th. Welcome. We've got a great informational meeting to start off with on the Oregon Project Independence. So I open the informational meeting and call up Commissioner Loretta Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming down from Portland.
Yes, it feels a little
a lot of rain on the way down.
Yes, ma'am. Chair, I just want to thank you and the rest of the committee for giving me an opportunity today to come down and talk about something that's very near and dear to my heart. When I looked at the governor's budget and saw that there was a 75% reduction.
Could you just state your name for the record, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Cassandra. Hi, my name's Loretta Smith, and I'm a Multnomah County Commissioner in Portland, Oregon. And it's an honor to be here to be able to speak in front of you, and good morning to all the members on the committee. As I was saying, when I looked at the governor's budget and there was a 75% cut for OPI, I was heartbroken. I was devastated. So what that does for us at Multnomah County, and you probably have my written testimony, and I'll just speak from the heart for just a bit, if you don't mind. We serve about 700 seniors with the OPI money. If these cuts go through, it's going to take away almost 590 of the 700 older adults that we serve and folks who have disabilities. That is going to be such a huge, huge blow to many people. Just a quick story. When I first bought my house in 96, I moved next door to a woman who I really cared a lot about, and she was an older adult. She was like 75, 77 years old. Lived next door to her for about 16 years, and she kept an immaculate yard. She even cut the yard with scissors and edged them. I mean, I was totally embarrassed, and I had a son, and I couldn't keep my yard together. But the issue is, she stayed in her home, and the reason why she was able to stay in her home is because she had help. She had help to be able to help her with, like, cleaning, cooking. She walked to the store every day, and she was really a part of the community. I wouldn't know what life was like without having her. She watched my house. She watched my son. When he locked himself out of the house after school, he could come over to her house and stay until I got off work. So, I mean, she was a true blessing for me. And I just think about those folks who don't have that kind of mobility. If we cut this in Multnomah County, it's going to be huge. It's going to be a huge, huge loss. Last year, I noticed that we had a huge waiting list. And so I added an amendment to the budget for about $450,000 to take our folks off the waiting list, because we were actually, you know, in my mind, it looked as if we were waiting for attrition to serve our folks in Multnomah County. And that's not who we are. We need to serve the people who need the help. Because just one quick number and I'll wrap up. If these people who need just a tiny bit of help, if they don't get that help, they're going to go into our nursing home system.
Right.
And how much does that cost? That's $18,000 a month. $18,000 a month compared to paying $350 per person to $400 a month. I mean, I'd say that is a huge, huge bargain. And I'd just like to urge the committee and all of the advocates that can come before you to continue to keep this program. It's such a great program. It provides so much service, and we have such a great quality of life when we have everyone in our community. And I know you all will do the right thing. And if I need to come back down here again and talk to the governor, I will. I think this is so important. Thank you.
I need to do that. Any questions for the commissioner?
Do you have a cell phone number?
I think the
governor's number?
Yes,
there.
I do.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Good to see you this morning.
Yes, good to be seen.
So with the Oregon Project Independence, does that go statewide, or is it specific to Multnomah County right now?
I think it is statewide.
Yeah. So it's covering
And in addition,
oftentimes those of us from Multnomah County are seen as kind of the big fishes and get everything. So I just want to, you know, it is statewide and it
it's
covers.
Statewide. And in addition to that, we also add some of our own money, Lee. We add some of our... Lee Gerard is in our aging services department. I think we add additional general fund money to fund the program.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for asking.
Thank you for your testimony. And thank you for your service for
yes.
all age ranges.
Yes.
Thank you,
thank you
so much. Okay, great. Next, we have Nicole Palmentier, Hazel Baker. And anyone who is lined up and would like to join her, Lee Gerard, Rodney Schroeder...
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nicole Palmentier Hazel Baker, currently running for longest name in this capital.
Barely edge me out.
Working on it. I am here today on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. Area Agencies on Aging are the statutory providers of Oregon Project Independence, and I'd like to thank the chair, the vice chairs in the committee for a little bit of time to draw attention to Oregon Project Independence, a program I'm sure you have all heard about from your constituents. If you haven't, you will. It's a program that does tremendous good. It is a program that is cost effective, but it's also programmatically very efficient and effective. And those are the kind of smart investments that we're looking for, I think, here, all of us together, as we look at what we do in the 17-19 budget. I will turn it over to our content experts here to talk about the program. And I will turn over to Lee first.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez and Stark, and committee members. I'm Lee Gerard, and I'm the Deputy Director with Multnomah County Aging, Disability, and Veteran Services Division. Our agency is the Area Agency on Aging in Multnomah County, and we're responsible for managing the Oregon Project Independence Program along with the Medicaid Long-Term Services Programs in our area. And my role here today is to share information about the program itself, how it operates, and give a little bit of information about the people that are served by the program. And when I'm talking about those people, I'll share a little example about Multnomah County, but I'll be talking mostly about statewide, what the service does for older adults and actually adults with disabilities in the state of Oregon. So OPI is an important part of Oregon's long-term services continuum. The goal of the program is to help those most at risk of premature or unnecessarily being moved to more restrictive care settings, providing a safety net for older adults and adults with disabilities who are not currently being served by Medicaid but are at risk of spending down or having to go on to Medicaid services. There are currently two OPI programs, one serving individuals that are 60 years and older. And that program was actually established in 1975, so it's been around a long time. And then there's also a second pilot program, which is serving adults with disabilities who are 19 to 59 years of age, and that is actually happening in seven areas throughout the state. And that was it was established in 2014. Services provided through OPI include things like personal care and in-home care, adult daycare services, assistive technology, registered nursing services, home-delivered meal services, and case management and service coordination. We see that for individuals with disabilities who are currently on our pilot programs, although they have a lot of the same kinds of needs, they vary a little bit because they're often still more active and engaged in the communities and may actually still be raising family members. So they have a higher need for things like medical transportation, and they may need a little bit of support related to how they stay engaged in the community. People are eligible for OPI if they are not receiving Medicaid services, other than they may be on SNAP, which is some people know as food stamps, and they may also be receiving some Medicare premium assistance. But otherwise, they are not receiving Medicaid, and they're not getting Oregon Health Plan services. So that's also another area where there's a cost difference in the programs. They also must meet functional eligibility for long-term services. And in Oregon, we use use the same assessment tool that is used for Medicaid services and the same service priority level classification system to make sure people are eligible for the services. OPI does serve a broader range than Medicaid. So in Medicaid, it's service levels that go 1 through 13. People could always help you understand what that means. But in OPI, it can be 1 through 18. So there is a little bit broader range.
Can I ask a question there?
Yes.
One being the most needy?
Yes. One's the most needy, and 18 is the least needy. So, people that are served in Oregon through the program, in the current biennium, we're estimating that approximately 4,000 people will be served through both of those services. Currently throughout the state, there are waiting lists for services, and that's around 1,000 people who currently could potentially be eligible for OPI, but there just isn't enough funding, and so they're on a wait list for services. And oftentimes, people in those local communities are trying to help them access other things that might be available, but it probably won't be things like in-home services and in-home care and personal care. The ages of individuals receiving OPI ranges from 29 years of age as the youngest person and 109 for the oldest, and there are currently 6 individuals on the program that are over 100 years old.
Wow.
The majority of people, actually, 55%, are between the ages of 71 and 90. And for the people with disabilities, the majority of folks are ages 50 to 59 for that group. The majority of individuals served in the program are women, which is not too surprising. Slight differences for the program for people with disabilities, a little bit higher rate of men being served in that program. The majority of individuals receiving OPI services do meet Medicaid nursing facility functional level of care. So if the program was eliminated, there's the potential that they could actually go on to Medicaid. A very large, significant proportion, over 90% of the people on the program are financially eligible for Medicaid, even though they're not currently accessing it. So just a little bit about our area. We do have, as mentioned, we're serving about 700 people currently in our area, and we estimate with the if the governor's recommended budget were to take place, we would have to eliminate services to about 590 people. And you do have some scenarios in your packet, but I just wanted to share about one of the individuals that we serve in our area. She's a 78-year-old woman. She lives alone. She has an income of $922 a month, which, if you know rents in Portland, that's not great. she used to be very independent and active, but over time, her multiple chronic disabilities led her to the point where she really was not able to get around very well, and she was not able to maintain her apartment. And because she lives in subsidized housing, she was almost evicted. And so through the OPI program, she's now getting some personal care assistance. She is getting housekeeping, and the OPI case, she was able to maintain her apartment and not face eviction, and the OPI case manager was actually able to help her access other resources in the community, like home-delivered meals, getting help paying for dentures, and also getting some assistance to pay for things like her durable medical equipment. So that's an example of somebody that we serve. So I appreciate the opportunity to share this information, and I know Rodney's going to share some more information, but I'm available for questions if you'd like.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rodney Schroeder. I work with Northwest Senior and Disability Services. We're the local area agency on aging that serves the Salem area, but we cover Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties. And as an area agency on aging, we do administer the Oregon Project Independence Program as well. And we do participate in the pilot program that Lee mentioned for younger persons with disabilities. So I get to talk about numbers today. So hopefully some of you are fans of numbers. In your packets, you've gotten some handouts that have some graphs and some numbers, and I'm going to be reviewing some of those with you today, so you can follow along there, and I'd be happy to answer questions as we move along as well. So all of you likely know that Oregon Project Independence is 100% funded out of the state general fund. So we don't get a federal match for that. And so sometimes that's a little bit of an issue because there's not federal matching dollars that come in there. But what our data is showing and what it shows is though, even though it's 100% state general fund, on average, it still costs significantly less to serve that consumer on Oregon Project Independence than it does for that same consumer that meets eligibility to move into the Medicaid program. So on average, it costs $332 a month to serve an OPI consumer. If that same consumer were in the Medicaid program, there would be that state-federal partnership in that, but the state dollars alone would be on average $803, and so significantly more than just the general fund portion of OPI. If that consumer moved into community-based care, that average of the state dollars would be $846, and if that consumer moved into a nursing facility, that state cost would be over $3,000 a month for that consumer. So again, it's 100% state general fund, but even the state portion, the state dollars, are much better. They go much further, and it serves the consumer at much less cost than the full Medicaid program. Some other data in the Oregon Project Independence Program, people contribute toward their cost of care on a sliding scale based on what their income is. So those at the very lowest income may not contribute to their cost of care, but as their income rises, they'll begin to pay a portion of the hourly rate for their home care worker, and those at the highest levels of income will pay for their full amount of their OPI services. And those program fees, we call them the program fees and the copays that are gathered. In fiscal year 2014, we collected more than $116,000 as a state in the program fees that the consumer contributed toward their cost of care. Also in the OPI program, as Lee mentioned, the individual doesn't have the Oregon Health Plan. So an individual that moves on to Medicaid, there's an automatic full medical card under the Oregon Health Plan that goes into those costs as well. Lee mentioned this, but it's worth saying again. 96% of those consumers that are in the Oregon Project Independence Program meet financial eligibility for their income for the Medicaid program. So 96% of those people could move in financially to the Medicaid program, and more than half, or about 60% of the individuals, meet that service priority level of 1 through 13 where they could move into the Medicaid program as well. And then the final piece on that aspect, on the dollars itself, at $332 a month of general fund, that's about 10% of the general fund cost of an individual in a nursing facility. So if an individual left Oregon Project Independence, went in on Medicaid, and went into a nursing facility, just the general fund portion, we would pay 10 times as much general fund for that individual in the nursing facility. So this is smart money. That's what advocates talk about. It's a smart money. It's smart investment, and it keeps people in their homes. Back in fiscal year 2014, our agency partnered with Department of Human Services to do an evaluation on what this demographic looks like within the Oregon Project Independence Program. Lee covered a couple of them, but let me do a few more highlights. The average gross income of these individuals, $1,225 a month, so fairly low income, especially as Lee mentioned, when our rents are where they are today, that money doesn't go very far. The median income, $1,162. So these are not people of high means. These are people of very modest means. And again, over 96% of them meet then the income criteria for the Medicaid program. The average in 2014, when we did this evaluation, the average age of the OPI consumer was 79 years old. As Lee mentioned, the predominantly female, or more than half are female. And in comparison, the average age of a Medicaid consumer on the senior or the aging Medicaid program was 74 at that time. So just a slight older demographic than what was on Medicaid for that population. And again, I mentioned 60% were and service priority levels 1 through 13, which would meet that Medicaid eligibility. So as a 100% general fund, the funding for Oregon Project Independence has been cyclical. Some bienniums were up a little bit, some were down. Makes it very difficult to manage the program, and it's very difficult for those on the program having some fear of what's going to happen. In 13-15, we had a pretty significant increase in the Oregon Project Independence funding because of that special purpose appropriation, and the legislature gave the OPI program extra monies with that special purpose appropriation, and we began to serve more people and get people off of waiting list and served. When we got into the current biennium, there was about $1 million less statewide for OPI, so most areas, almost all areas now, are on a waiting list. Our agency started this biennium on a waiting list because with the increased dollars in 13-15, we had began to serve a high enough level of consumers that we needed to have, through attrition, those numbers come down a little bit to meet the budget by the end of the biennium. So our count has come down over 100 consumers in our 5-county service area over the biennium. And there are, as Lee mentioned, there's over 1,000 people statewide that are on that waiting list. So in the governor's recommended budget, and the commissioner from Multnomah mentioned, there's a 75% reduction. And so we already have a waiting list of 1,000-plus people, and with a 75% reduction, that's catastrophic to a program that keeps people in their homes, keeps them off of Medicaid, and improves their quality of life. There'll be a lot of individuals that would have to lose services, and some of them, not all of them, but many of them would probably go on to Medicaid, and the end result would probably still be more money in general fund on Medicaid than funding the OPI program. So those are the general demographics. In your packet, there's a couple profiles as well. I'll highlight the one from Tillamook County. That's one of the profiles that's in our area. This is Kathleen. She's an OPI consumer. She's a service priority level 10, which is that in that range that's Medicaid eligible as well. Her income level does fall within that range where she would be financial eligible for Medicaid. She's 79 years old, has a host of chronic conditions that you'll see on your profile, and she lives in her own home. Without the supports of Medicaid, at the cost of about $332 a month, she wouldn't be able to remain in her own home and would have to go into some type of a facility, possibly on Medicaid, and if on Medicaid, most definitely at a higher cost to the state than the $332 a month. The average Medicaid in-home consumer is $2,230 a month, of which $803 are state general fund. So that's an example of if that individual lost services, moved into Medicaid, it would be a higher cost. So I'll kind of wrap there. I'm available for questions as well. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for opportunity to give you some information on OPI, and we're happy to take any questions.
That's great. Thank you. Questions from the committee? I have a couple brief questions. One is 1,000 on the wait list. What is the total number on the traditional OPI program, and what's the number served last year on the pilot for people with disabilities?
You know those off your head. So, Chair Kenny Guy, we don't know the exact numbers right now. We'll get them back to you.
Okay, great.
You asked for roughly. We could maybe do that, but it'd be best to get you within a quick time.
And then what I recall from the governor's budget is I think that it went from $22 million last year to $5 million. Is that correct? So since you said a 75% reduction, I'm guessing maybe $20 million went to the traditional program and perhaps $2 million to the pilot project. And when you talk about 1,000 on the wait list, I'm also guessing that you're meaning seniors on the traditional program as opposed to people on a wait list for pilot. That's something that you could expand if there were money, but you're not even focused on that right now.
Right. Chair Kenny Geyer, the governor's budget did move OPI, the program for older adults, down to $5 million, and it also it completely eliminated the program for people with disabilities, which was $6 million. So the total reduction would be right around $21 million grand total out the door with both of the programs together. So the senior program took a 75% reduction. The program for people with disabilities took a 100% reduction and would completely eliminate the program in the seven areas. You are correct.
So it took 27
$7 million down to $5
million. Right, $27 down to $5 million. Okay. If we had the capacity, and certainly if we were in a different climate, one of the goals that we were working on with our stakeholders was to see about expanding the program statewide for people with disabilities. There's certainly a need there. And it's also, again, as Rodney discussed, there's not only a need programmatically for people to have an option, another way as we're trying to look at ways to use our money most efficiently, but it would also be an opportunity to help people who would like to stay independent, who would perhaps not choose to move on to the Medicaid program, who would prefer to stay in their home, stay in their community without some of the restrictions or some of the criteria that comes with Medicaid. However, unfortunately, we just don't have that option. And if this program were eliminated, the younger people with disabilities, we would do what we could, and we would probably have to move as many as we could as possible to Medicaid.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schroeder, what did you say the median income again was? Was it $1,100 a month?
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Gorsuch, the median income on the evaluation was, I'm getting mine,
$1,162. $1,162. And then follow up, please.
Yes.
So, this is predicated on current levels for Medicare, Medicaid, right? And do we have any indication of what the federal government may do with Medicare, Medicaid? I mean, that seems like it's an up in the air question.
Chair Kenny Guy, Representative Gorsuch, I wish we knew.
Yeah,
we don't.
That's what I was afraid of.
If you know, let us know, please. We'd love to hear it. But we don't know. So, you know, we can only operate off of the current Medicaid regulation that we work under now, current income criteria that we work off of now. And those are the numbers, you know, that we're able to pull for you and come up with the kinds of data that we have.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. And next up, we have John Bartholomew from AARP and Kendall Mason from SEIU.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I am the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon, a state organization with over 500,000 members across the state. And I want to focus my comments today not just on the direct care, but the spillover effect that OPI has on the families of those who are served. I mean, you've already heard a lot about what OPI does, how it helps the individual people who are on the program, but a significant number of the people served by OPI are living with others. And now it does prioritize those who are single, but many of them also have a family caregiver at home. Maybe it's a spouse, maybe it's a child that's living and helping to take care of them. As you've heard me give testimony on other issues, we have about 470,000 family caregivers across Oregon, and they are really the foundation of our long-term care system, providing over $5 billion worth of care every year. What OPI does for many of these folks, so about 55 to 60% of these family caregivers are still employed and working. Oregon Project Independence helps allow those folks to continue to work and go to their job and bring resources into the family to prevent them from falling deeper into poverty and becoming reliant on Medicaid, as was noted earlier. It also allows family members to retain health insurance benefits, so that's critical for the family. If without OPI, many caregivers would need to leave that workplace so they could care for their loved one full time, and they would lose their health insurance, financial resources in the process. And then the demands of full-time caregiving are exceedingly stressful. There's plenty of data that shows that there's a health impact on family caregivers. that makes them more susceptible to disease, health complications. One of the reasons I really got involved in the issue of family caregiving is when I heard a doctor in Medford, he was a neurologist, treats a lot of folks with Alzheimer's disease. He noted that all too often he sees the family caregiver of the person with dementia die from stress-related ailments before the person with Alzheimer's does. You know, that's whether it's heart attack, stroke, suicide. And so I want to be really focused on family caregivers and make sure that they have some supports. And OPI, while focused on the care recipient, can provide some respite for family caregivers. It reduces that stress level short term so that they can be themselves, they can continue to work, and they can not burn out on family caregiving. One of the other features of Oregon Project Independence is that it allows for some home modifications so that the individual can live in their home longer. And a simple thing like adding grab bars to the shower can allow for the family caregiver to not have to be so hands-on with bathing, and that individual will have their independence and dignity preserved. Now, AARP Oregon was really hoping to come into this session and asking for expanded funding for OPI. Knowing how things are in the budget this year, we really urge the legislature to at least hold the line at current service level for this fantastic program. And in the future, we would love to participate in discussions about ways that we might be able to find other resources to supplement this, whether with some matching federal funds or with some more state funds down the road. It is one of the best programs this state has, cost-effective, makes a difference in people's lives, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having me this morning. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark. My name is Kendall Mason, and I am the political and policy strategist for SEIU Local 503. And I'm here today to talk about our support for the Oregon Project Independence and the fact that it keeps costs down for long-term care and allows for seniors to stay in their home and live longer and more independent lives. The Oregon Project Independence, OPI, fills a void for our long-term care system, and it helps fill the cracks that many Oregonians would be falling into otherwise. Because OPI offers the sliding scale access to in-home supports, people who might not qualify for those supports through Medicaid are able to avoid the dreaded Medicaid spend-down. And Medicaid spend-down happens when people try to access those services through Medicaid by offloading any of their assets and liquidating any of their savings so that they can actually finally receive the supports that they need. Excuse me. And because many of the people are avoiding Medicaid spend down and the inevitable placement in a nursing home, it ends up saving the state countless dollars and improves quality of life. The service this program provides to Oregonians not only improves the quality of life of thousands of seniors and people with disabilities, but it also provides a lot of jobs. OPI currently helps employ home care workers for people throughout the state. The proposed cut to the program, leaving only the maintenance of effort investment, would cost roughly 1,600 to 1,700 jobs across the state. And they're not workers with excess cash. These are people, when they lose this job, they're going to have trouble paying their rent, paying their bills, and trying to get their mortgages paid. Not only will these consumers throughout the state lose access to home care and their independence, we have 1,600 to 1,700 people across the state that are going to be losing their jobs. OPI has been a crowning achievement in the Oregon long-term care since its inception in the mid-70s, and we need to do the work and make the right choice to keep OPI as is and even expand it as we move forward if we want Oregon to remain on the forefront of long-term care and keep people in their homes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Okay, that wraps up our Oregon Project Independence informational hearing. As you know, we're not the budget committee, we're the policy committee, but we certainly have a right to weigh in on the budget decisions. So that was a great introduction, and I'm going to close the informational hearing on Oregon Project Independence and open a public hearing on House Bill 2547, which appropriates money from the general fund to the Gatekeeper Program, which is a very complementary program to OPI. And we are honored to have Representative Jody Heck join us to kick it off. And Jody, while you're sitting down, we'll have the committee analyst read the summary of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2547 appropriates money from the general fund to the Department of Human Services for operation of Northwest Senior and Disability Services Gatekeeper Program. The bill declares an emergency as an effective July 1st, 2017.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jody Hack, and I'm state representative for House District 19, which represents South Salem, parts of South Salem, Almsville, and Turner. I have the pleasure of bringing to you House Bill 2547, which references the Gatekeeper Program. The Gatekeeper Program is a community-based elder abuse prevention program that the state invested $1.8 million in the past. It's a state-run program that actually worked with volunteers across the state to prevent elder abuse. It'd be a shame to do away with this program after we made such a large investment in such an important issue. This bill would allow for us to continue a small investment to keep the program at the forefront and not completely do away with it. It allows for the Northwest seniors with disabilities to have one staff person that would work on a regional basis to go out and continue to keep the issue alive with the volunteers that we worked with over a period of time with that larger investment, so that we continue to foster those relationships, continue to keep the issue ongoing rather than just make that investment and turn around and walk away. Without having someone working across our state, at least on a regional basis, touching folks, the fear is that the issue and the work that was done will be for nothing. Not the issue, but the work that was done would be for nothing. So that $1.8 million investment, if not continued to foster, then all those volunteers simply would feel that the investment that they made of their time and the investment made by the state basically meant nothing. And our elder population deserves better. This is a small investment. We do need to make an amendment to the bill. After having more conversations with Northwest seniors with disabilities, you're going to hear from those folks today. There will be a little bit larger fiscal, not a whole lot, but there was a little bit larger salary and then some costs for travel. So we'll do a small amendment to that. But again, the cost to continue to work with our elder folks, and the volunteers are amazing. The people across our state that are willing to continue to watch out for our elder folks. Are their bank accounts, is there activity in their bank accounts that doesn't look right? Are their papers, you know, piling up on their front porches? Are there little things that these volunteers have been trained to watch for? Are we fostering that? Are we doing the best job that we can possibly do? And are we saying thank you to the volunteers and making sure that we are, as a state, saying that we care about the work that and the time that you invested as volunteers and the dollars that we put into that? So for a small amount of money, the Northwest Seniors with Disabilities folks are willing to put forth their time and efforts and a staff person to do this work. So I would hope that you would consider this bill and consider moving it forward for the small fiscal that it does contain. And with that, you're going to hear from some other folks that can probably talk to you about some statistics and some things that I think are really important to hear too.
Okay.
Do you have any questions for me?
Any questions for Representative Hack? No, thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have first up, Chuck Richards, Julie Sobel, and Nicole Palmateer-Hazelbaker.
You let me go first. Chair Kenny Geyer and the rest of the committee, I want to introduce myself. I'm Charles Richards. I'm a professional groupie here at the Capitol, and I'm here to talk about one of my favorite things. I am not a numbers person. I'm the other side. I'm the passion person, and I want to talk about why the gatekeeper really is worthwhile. Yesterday, I went to a local savings and loan association, and I was doing some business, and I got to talking to the gal that was taking care of me, and she said that her training from this program had had a lot to do with catching things that most people wouldn't see, but as a financial person, she saw the accounts fluctuate when they shouldn't and some other things, and so she was able to stop that. Well, the gatekeeper program really isn't a very expensive program. It's pretty low priced, and in these days that there's not as much money to put around, it's a place where you're going to be able to put money, and it will go a long ways because these people are volunteers. I have been, for the last 8 years of my life, I've been a volunteer for seniors and people with disability, and I find that you feel like you have an investment in that situation, and that's what this program does. Those people know that they have a role to play, and it makes them feel that they're buying into the system, and I think that's well worth it. So it's a win-win situation, and you know, you get jaded in this place because dollar amounts sound tremendous if it's your personal money, but if it's state money, you know, this is a very small amount, and it would be very worthwhile for so many people, and it'll stop a lot of elder abuse. We're very conscious of this elder abuse, and I hate to say it, but 70% of this is coming from family members. So it's a big situation, and I plan on being on the fight as long as I possibly can because I think it's well worth it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Sobel, and I am the Gatekeeper and Money Management Programs Coordinator at Northwest Senior and Disability Services. We are a local area agency on aging, which serves Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Tillamook, and Clatsop counties. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today on House Bill 2547 and share some of the benefits to the local community of the Gatekeeper Program. I'll also be sharing with you some success stories that have come from recent referrals through the program so you can truly understand the magnitude of the benefit in terms of providing safety and services to the most vulnerable citizens of our community. Gatekeeper Program is an outreach and referral program. It's unique in its effectiveness because it focuses on empowering everyday people to identify, respond, and refer at-risk adults with disabilities and seniors to our Aging and Disability Resource Connection, also known as the ADRC. The ADRC then connects those people to the appropriate programs, services, or resources. Such connections could be medication management, in-home care services, Meals on Wheels, any number of programs we offer, but also resources outside our agency. The gatekeeper training is provided to people who in the normal course of their lives encounter seniors and adults with disabilities. This could be law enforcement, bank tellers, bus drivers, letter carriers, just to name a few. With a portion of the funds originally provided to the program, our agency developed a video, which is used during the training process, and a copy of it is left behind so that these collaborating partner organizations can implement that training video into their new employee orientation to give a longer lasting effect beyond just that initial training from our agency. There have been over 500 presentations, excuse me, there have been over 50 presentations and 88 outreach events since July of 2014. And over 1,000 community members have been trained as gatekeepers in just our five-county service area. Referrals are often made for those who are most vulnerable, those who are homebound, those who struggle with mental illness, those who have no contact with family or friends. There have been 202 gatekeeper referrals to just our ADRC since July of 2014. One such gatekeeper referral came from a local senior center volunteer. The volunteer called the ADRC to seek assistance for a consumer who had multiple sclerosis. She was unable to take care of her bills and had a lot of mobility issues. She lived on a second floor apartment and hadn't been out of her home in 5 months. The ADRC connected her to in-home care services and to the money management program. Due to the connections made, this consumer was able to receive assistance to file her PERS benefits and receive more monthly income, and also fill out an application for a first floor unit in low-income housing, and she saved $546 a month on her monthly bills. The first floor apartment, of course, increased her quality of life and independence. Another referral came from a social worker at a hospital. A patient who struggles with mental health issues had been left at a motel by her caretaker brother, who is also her representative payee responsible for managing her federal benefits. He moved out of town and closed her bank account. She was found unconscious by the motel housekeeper and sent to the ER. Upon recovery, she was transferred to nursing care, and when appropriate, she was ready to transition to a lower level of care in assisted living. But no assisted living residents would take her because she had no source of income. The social worker made a gatekeeper referral to the ADRC, and the ADRC connected her to our diversion and transition team that found her a place to live, and the money management program, who applied to be her representative payee. Both the consumer and the state benefited in this outcome because her nursing care was costing Medicaid over $8,000 a month, and assisted living reduced that expense to $1,200 a month. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thank you for your time. I'd welcome any questions.
That's great. Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? No, thank you. It's very compelling. So next up we have, I'm sorry, you haven't gone yet. I heard you talk
okay.
Before and I forgot. No, we're
him. Really fast. Sure, you think I remember the committee for the record, still Nicole Palmateer Hazelbaker, still really long last name. Here today on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. The area agencies were, and in some cases still are, the providers of the gatekeeper program around the state. We really appreciate Representative Hack's attention to community abuse that's happening in the state of Oregon and what we can do to prevent it in very cost-effective ways. A report by the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention from the Department of Human Services a few years ago indicated that while we have put a lot of very important resources and dedication of time and effort towards facility-based abuse, community-based abuse goes up and continues to go up, and it is a hard one to find. It's hard to find, it's hard to know, and it's hard for people to identify that. The Gatekeeper Program, which is a nationally based program, has been built-in research, is a way to help expand resources, help people who, as Julie said, come into natural day-to-day contact with individuals, help them identify what that means. One partnership was actually Jackson County Fire District 3. They learned about the Gatekeeper program, started working with the area agency there so that all of their firefighters were gatekeeper trained and were able to make those kinds of identifiers when they're out on the scene, which was a really unique partnership that we appreciated, and there were many of those around the state. When the program was operational, over 10% of the calls that we would receive due to the Gatekeeper program actually resulted in an abuse investigation. So it was doing the work that it was meant to. We appreciate working with Representative Hack. As she mentioned, there are amendments coming to look at the scope of this at a statewide, what can we do at the statewide level to just help support the volunteers that have already been trained, organizations that have already stepped forward to try not to lose as much momentum as we might and help to continue to have some sort of program that's looking at how we can help lower community-based abuse for our vulnerable citizens. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, any questions from this panel? Thank you so much. Next up, Judy Richards and John Bartholomew. And is there anyone else that wanted to testify on this? Come on up.
Well, I get to bring in the tale of this. Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chairs and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about a very important subject. Obviously, I'm getting older, and I have taken care of someone.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
Judy Richards, okay. And I am from Salem, and I represent seniors and people with disabilities. And as the years go by, we never think we're going to be in that position. I took care of my mother until she was 101, and so I saw lots of firemen. And they are adorable. And she loved them. But the Gatekeeper program keeps people like all of us are going to be someday safe. Safe from many things. You've already heard the testimonies of several people, and people have, you know, all the dollars and cents and the numbers, and those are the people that I know are important to you because you face a very difficult time right now with the budget being what it is. So I will just tell you what I know best, and that's the impact on people. People, your mothers, your fathers, your uncles, your aunts. I'm sure some of you have heard phone calls from people in your constituency who have said, what do I do? Chuck talked about meeting the banker. I was with him when he met the banker. And she said, why are there no more of us? Mm. And they're so proud of what they do. I mean, as he was sitting there talking to her, doing his banking business, we couldn't get her to stop talking about the Gatekeeper program. Then her manager had to come over and talk about the Gatekeeper program. I mean, it's like these people are excited. And they want to know, why isn't more done? Why aren't there more of us out there understanding how they do this? And it wasn't just about financial abuse. They sit people down. They separate partners from others who are talking about taking mom's money out or uncle's money out or cashing large checks. It's not just about that. They're also aware of why hasn't Betty been to the bank in a long time. She's always here the first of every month, you know, and she always gets the candy out of the jar, but she hasn't been here. They make phone calls. Mm. I mean, in today's world, when we're afraid to offend, this is rather remarkable. And, you know, I would hope with this program having such little fiscal impact that you can just say, you know, we can figure it out. And that's what we're really counting on right now. These are our most vulnerable people, and they're isolated. There are people with disabilities. There are people who are seniors. It could be anyone you know. We used to be that we knew the folks next door, and we were able to say, you know, why hasn't she picked up the mail? Why has the dog been barking for 3 days? What's going on? The trash cans didn't get to the corner. My neighbors would notice. But, you know, I'm three houses down. Would anybody else notice? Mm-hmm. It's important that we don't feel like we are interfering on other people's lives. In the world of political correctness, mm-hmm. we are so afraid that someone will be upset by, can I help you? Mm-hmm. What's going on? Met a lady at the Dairy Queen the other day, and as we were sitting there having our coffee, and yes, she was disheveled and she was dirty and she was confused. How many people are going to stop and say, what's going on? Can we help you? How's your day going? Mm-hmm. And finding out, do they need help? This woman had fallen in the parking lot, had a gash. She had a walker that looked like it had come through whatever. I wouldn't be using that walker. But, you know, in her moments, she said, I have a husband who's coming. I just don't know where he is. I mean, she was very confused. So if we would have had somebody in that Dairy Queen who would have noticed, they probably would have said, can I call someone for you? And if not, helped in some other way. We need to fund the Gatekeeper program to train people.
We're starting to run out of time. So, try to wrap up.
If we save these vulnerable people, then we'll be helping ourselves. All I'm asking is to put this program back to work, and help us save the lives and seniors of people with disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We see a lot of you in this building, so if you can be really brief with your testimony, because you can reach us anytime.
I'll be extremely brief. Okay. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, again for the record, John Bartholomew, AARP Oregon. We love the Gatekeeper program. In fact, when I used to work for the Alzheimer's Association, we drafted the state plan for Alzheimer's disease in Oregon, shorthanded to SPADO. One of the recommendations in that was to expand the Gatekeeper program statewide. We knew that it had been functioning extremely well in Multnomah County for actually a couple of decades by that point. And as a result of changes to the senior medical deduction that created a lot of savings, the legislature funded for a couple of years expanding this Gatekeeper program statewide. And programs were launched. A lot of people were helped, protected from abuse and neglect and isolation. So what I'm here to say is we love this program, but we'd love to see it expanded statewide again because it was defunded last year. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Jim Davis with the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens and the United Seniors of Oregon, state affiliates of the National Council on Aging. Very quickly, we just want to express our very strong support for the Gatekeeper program. It utilizes community resources very effectively, saves a lot of money by keeping people, hopefully, from more dire emergency situations. On this bill, we, of course, support this bill. We support any money going to the Gatekeeper. I would agree with John that it's a little limited. We want it to be statewide. It's one of our big priorities. But any kind of money going anywhere is good. And the Northwest Senior and Disability Services are an excellent AAA, and any kind of pilot they would do would be superior. And also, we like what O4AD is doing in terms of trying to create more of a state coordination effort in the interim as the program can then be reorganized later. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? No? Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for coming. And thank you, Representative Hack. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2547. Representative Hack has been kind to let us go do some work sessions on some of the bills that we passed last time, and we are going to revisit your last two bills, if that's still all right with you, at the end of that. So we want to get a few of these bills that are starting to stack up out of our committee. And so I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2216, Foster Children Sibling Bill of Rights. Could you please remind us the summary of the bill and then tell us the amendment that we will be, we will have a motion to move.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2216 establishes specified rights for foster children. The bill directs Department of Human Services to adopt rules establishing the Oregon Foster Children Sibling Bill of Rights and directs DHS to review the rules periodically and promote participation of current and former foster children in developing the rules. We last heard this bill on February 9th. And we have a -2 amendment which clarifies terms for foster child and sibling and expands the essential rights of siblings who are foster children to include documentation of rights, explanation of contact, denial with siblings, applicability of rights, active engagement in contact with siblings, and ability to testify at guardianship proceedings.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated 2/13 of 2017.
Rep. Stark moves to adopt the -2 amendments dated 2/13/17. Is there any discussion? Representative Stark, I would love, because you had something, yes. you knew about these amendments, you weighed in on them, so.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. Tell Oregon Foster Youth, thank you for being receptive. Some of the even little details, sometimes like the form of electronic communication can pose interesting discussions, so I appreciate you guys being receptive to pretty much every comment I gave you guys. And so appreciate your work on this and sorting things out. And for those who don't know, I was a little sensitive on the social media part because some parents don't let their children use social media. And so that, so they've changed that to electronic communication to broaden that a little bit. Anyway, we've been having a great dialogue. I'm proud of how you, what you've brought the bill to. So, yeah.
Okay. So is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted. Now, I was hoping that we would have a fiscal on this by this morning, but apparently we do not. Is that correct?
Correct.
So, unfortunately, we cannot move the bill to the floor. Well, I'm actually not sure if it was to Ways and Means, but we cannot move the bill out of our committee in any case. So we will revisit this, and we won't have a content discussion. We'll hopefully just have the vote. Okay, so I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2216. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2344, the qualifications and requirements for minors in independent living programs. Could you please remind us of the bill?
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. House Bill 2344 revises qualifications for minors to participate in independent living programs. The bill modifies activity requirements of residents in independent living programs to include volunteer activities and allowing exceptions to the requirements. We last heard this bill on February 9th, and we have the -1 amendments, which change terms from minors to persons and clarifies the age for participation in independent residence facilities. We have both the fiscal and the revenue statements for this bill.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 2/13 of 2017.
Rep. Stark moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated 2/13/17. Is there any discussion? I do want to point out that the fiscal was minimal, so nothing to speak of, and these are more technical changes. Minimal meaning probably nothing. They were just still operating the program. Okay, so any further discussion? Any objection to the amendment? If not, the amendments are adopted, and we are.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2344 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that, wait a second, I'm looking at the wrong page. That's it.
That's what I move.
Okay.
Yep, that's correct.
All right. Rep. Stark moves House Bill 2344 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gorsley?
Yes.
Representative Kerr?
Aye.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Chair Geyer?
Aye. The motion passes. Who would like to carry this measure on the floor? Any volunteers?
Of course. I would love to. Oh. I was just going to say that. So thank you. We were reading each other's mind. I'll do it.
Okay.
Happy to do it.
Representative Gorsuch will do it. And thank you for also being willing to step up. I think that the Sibling Bill of Rights is hopefully going to come back to us
soon. That will be mine.
We may have a couple co-carriers on the floor on that one. Okay, great. So I close the work session on House Bill 2344. And we, 2401 has an amendment that was posted. There was already a -1 amendment, and that's been on OLIS, but there was a -2 amendment that we'll be discussing that was posted at 8:34. So we'll consider passing that after 9:34, because it's got to be on OLIS for an hour, and we can explain that at the time. So we're going to hold off on 2401 for a little bit. We are also going to have some discussion before that, but we will move. Let me see. Are there any other House amendments? 2500. No amendment yet. On, I got to close the. Sorry, I don't think I did that yet. Did I close the session on 23? Okay, thank you. House Bill 2401, we'll come back to 2500. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2500, not for the purpose of moving anything, but for the purpose of catching you up. Representative Stark, would you like to just catch us up on where we are in House Bill 2500?
So, yes, thank you, Chair.
No amendments yet.
House Bill 2500, I've was a little confused about the origins of that at the time. I since then talked to previous Representative Wayne Krieger, talked to Department of Justice and DHS briefly. We maybe have a couple amendments on who we would desire to do that training and whether or not we think that training would cause a fiscal. And so it's an ongoing conversation that that we hope to return to soon.
Okay. Close house, the work session on House Bill 2500. Open a work session on House Bill 2221 for the purpose of just letting you know where that is. This is the reimbursement of child abuse medical assessments. We are anticipating some amendments. We were hoping they would be here so you could consider moving them, but they're not here yet. Is that correct? Okay, I'm going to close House Bill 2221. I don't know. Close the work session on it. And because we want to delay for a little bit the 2401, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2551, prohibits the placement of a child with intellectual disability in a hotel. We don't have anyone signed up for this as yet, but we have Representative Hack representing it. And could you please read us the summary of the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2551 prohibits placement of a child with intellectual disability in a hotel, motel, inn, hospital, Department of Human Services office, or juvenile detention facility while in protective custody. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, State Representative Jody Hack. I represent South, parts of South Salem, Almsville, and Turner. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to present to you House Bill 2551. These bills are difficult for me. I just got to say thanks for being on this committee. This would be so hard for me. I think some of the issues in this bill have been addressed with the Department of Human Services. However, this issue, particular issue, was brought to me by a constituent who happened to work for one of the providers who were hired to care for a child with developmental disabilities in one of the hotels that were paid approximately $11,000 a month to house one of, actually several children in hotels. At the time, she said they thought they had about 30, which is just absolutely disheartening to me. One of the things I think that was of most concern to me, I have a nephew that has severe disabilities, and the idea of him sitting in a hotel room and not going to school, not going to daycare, it was a 24-hour a day, 7 days a week. They weren't taken out of the hotel. They were provided a person to basically sit in the hotel room with them 24/7. So she was extremely disheartened, and their company was paid the money to do this type of work. So she came to me, and I'm not surprised that she's not here, probably for fear of her job. But I just appreciated the fact that she came to me and felt an absolute responsibility to bring this forward. I realize there's probably a very large fiscal to this, but I think it's important that we have these conversations. In light of some of the changes in the movement that DHS has made, and I think that they're trying to do some really good work, so I don't want to come across that I'm just pointing a finger at them, because I think that they're trying to make some positive movement. I do think that we could make an amendment to this bill, though, that would address that they would only utilize the hotel if it's in an emergency situation, which I think and folks from DHS may be here and they could chime in that they've already mentioned that they might do that. But we need to define emergency, and I think that this bill should do that, that if we allow them to utilize the hotels for our children with developmental disabilities, because I understand that it's difficult to find placement. I've talked to the folks that they have those facilities that oftentimes they're full and there isn't anywhere to put the kids. But I think we need to define what an emergency is, and I also think that we need to have parameters and sideboards around that that say DHS staff will still ensure that those children are taken to school or they're taken to daycare, and that this isn't a 24-hour, 7-day a week sit in a hotel room simply because there's nowhere else for you to go. So I would propose that we look at an amendment. I'm happy to work with DHS or if there's somebody on the committee that wants to help with that. But I think that we need to put some parameters around that. I think some of the other issues, like I said, have been addressed. Obviously, hospitals and those kinds of things. I think that DHS has already addressed those issues as far as if there's a need for them to be there, they've taken care of that. But I think the hotel issue definitely needs to be defined. So with that, no, if there's any questions.
Thank you, Representative Hack. Questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair Kinney-Geyer. So thanks for your testimony, and I agree with you. This is a tough list to look at of these places where kids end up. And, you know, you kind of talked a lot about hotels, and I always feel like when I go to a hotel, it's kind of a little bit of a lonely place, and I'm not a foster kid or anything like that. So it kind of makes me sad to look at this list. But then I think, so if you take all of these options away, then what happens? Where does the kid go? Does he just ride around in the back of a police car all day? Or, I mean, I'm trying to think of what does this turn into? Do you have anything on that?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Representative Nierman, I think that's why DHS has worked to define kind of some of these already. Like, when do they go to the juvenile detention center? When do they go to the hospital? So some of these have already been addressed, and DHS is working on those. And they have said we have to utilize a hotel. We don't have a choice because we simply don't have anywhere else for them to go. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't utilize a hotel, exactly what you said would happen. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to say is, what defines an emergency? Is an emergency simply because we didn't have time to make the calls to place them somewhere else? What parameters are we going to put on that? I mean, I would like to know that every single option has been exhausted before we choose to put a child in a hotel. And I also want to make sure that if we do that, that they are given every opportunity and every right to make sure that they are in school, or that they get out of that hotel and they're placed in a daycare setting or something, because they certainly shouldn't be there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And then what's the criteria to make sure they get out? Because some of these kids are there for days and days and days and days. So I just want to see some parameters put around it. But that's exactly what this does. It addresses exactly what your question is.
Representative Hurd, and then Vice Chair Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hack, for bringing this to the committee. I've had some cases with constituents back home where we've talked about, you know, children being left in an office at DHS because there is no foster care for them and whatnot. So if I understand you correctly, this conversation needs to happen because we need to prevent isolationism regardless of where they are staying. And there's a greater conversation to be had. So, yes, and I appreciate what Representative Nierman brought up about, you know, where do we put them? Even though this list is unpleasant, there has to be somewhere to go when there is no foster care no longer available. So it's definitely a cause that we need to be looking into and figure this out and do a better job as a legislature of tailor-fitting this to our children's needs. So thank you.
And Chair Kinney-Geyer and Representative Hurd, you know, and I want to stress that this isn't a finger-pointing or a they didn't do this or she didn't, you know, DHS didn't do that or whoever. It's not about that. This is about all of us taking responsibility for doing what's best for our kids. And we have an issue. We have a lack of foster homes that'll take kids with developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. We have a crisis, but at what point do we take responsibility and say, let's put the safeguards around our kids and the parameters to say, this is what's okay, this isn't, but at the same time realizing that DHS can only do what they can do, but let's also put the safeguards around it. So,
Vice Chair Stark.
Yes, thank you, Rep. Kinney-Geyer. Hack, I wish there was somebody else that I could harass about this rather than you. Right now we have a case in Jackson County that I'm concerned about, and I'm still trying to sort through all the details of a 10-year-old who is in detention that is waiting to be moved. He needs to go to Jasper Mountain, and so but there's no open beds. And so the police officers had an option, and the courts had an option. We either charge him with something where we can put him in detention, or we send him back home, which where he's not safe because he needs help. Mm-hmm. And I'm very unhappy about those being the only two options there. And I hate the idea of children in hotels and offices and all that. I'm wondering if we get ourselves to a point, as these guys have kind of expressed, a point where we there is no option. So how do we help? And I think, I mean, my big plea that I will continue saying is, communities, you need to step up and open up your homes, if anybody's watching. But what do they do in that sort of situation?
Well, Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Stark, I think that defining, I mean, in that case, that's a court. I mean, if he's committed a crime, then obviously the detention center would be, I don't know that you have a choice with that. In these cases, I think defining what constitutes an emergency for the hotel stay. Now, if a crime hadn't been committed, then obviously that would constitute an emergency if there's no placement for this individual and it's not safe for him to go home and he can't be taken, there's no room for him at that point, then to me that constitutes an emergency. But what I'm saying is, let's define what that emergency is. Is the emergency that DHS staff just simply didn't have time to make the calls and they placed him in a hotel? And for how long? Is that 30 days? Because according to the individual who met with me, sometimes that happens. So that's my concern.
Fair enough.
Well, that's great. We need to move on. So I'm going to close. Okay, quickly.
Thank you. I'll make this quick. Just more of a comment, more of my experience. I'm going to jump on what Representative Stark said. And my experience with juvenile detention and placing a child there with a disability simply because there's no other place to go is, and I know that all of these places have their issues being isolated, but I've seen that. And even creative charging in order to get them into a facility because there's no other place to go. I think that is absolutely the last, and actually it shouldn't be an option. So if I were to pick a prioritization on this list, that would be the one that's absolutely not available.
Thank you.
Okay. So there's, can I do one?
Okay, really quickly.
Right, really fast. Well, and to dovetail with what Representative Noble said, if you look at a facility like JDH in Multnomah County, it's an incarceration facility, and so I absolutely agree. Putting them there would need to be the last resort. Of course, you have to go somewhere, but it is a serious problem when you, especially developmental disability folks, being put into an environment like that.
Yeah. Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Gorsuch, and Representative Noble, I think that's the key also. You're talking about developmentally disabled kids. That's a whole different spectrum. So I'd be happy to have any of you join in and help figure out how we amend this to make it work in a way that supports DHS and our kids.
Okay, so thank you. I want to make one comment before closing the public hearing on this bill. This is a huge issue. We don't have time to really get into it, but, you know, if you go upstream, the fact that we don't have enough placements, we're not doing enough support work for families and agencies that house kids in group settings, we have not been providing enough financial support, reimbursement, training. So those facilities lack. We don't have enough family certifiers, and so sometimes we hear that there are families that want to take kids, but their family certifiers are backed up. This is one area of the government where when kids need a foster family, the state of Oregon is their family, and I think that we've really let kids down, and this is one piece of it. And I would encourage us to continue to going upstream so we don't end up in this horrible situation where we've got no place for kids to go. So thank you for putting a spotlight on it. This is a really big piece of what I think that we need to deal with in this committee. And I really want to thank Representative Peluso and Representative Stark for having done a lot of work through task forces and commissions in this area. I know a number of you other people have also done a lot of work in your personal and professional careers outside the legislature. So it's a very, very, very important issue. So thank you for bringing it to us. And I want to close public hearing on House Bill 2551. And I want to give a quick opportunity. I know we're a little behind to DHS. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2401 before we get to your last bill.
Okay, I'll
Representative Hack, because we wanted one of the questions about 2401, and I know that the DHS staff have been waiting patiently, was what are we doing in trauma-informed training for child welfare personnel? We have some amendments that we can pass possibly after 9:34, but we wanted to hear briefly from you. We'll have to be very brief because we want to leave enough time for Representative Hack's last bill. But we want to hear briefly from you about what are you doing in trauma-informed training for child care, child welfare personnel.
Great. I will be brief. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Hopkins, and I am the director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, also known as OAPI. It is a shared service between the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. Even though OAPI has the word adult in it, we also do abuse investigations into licensed child caring agencies. So that's kind of the backdrop for what I'm going to talk about here. We absolutely at OAPI recognize the value in having a trauma-informed approach to conducting our abuse investigations. We are currently making an investment in all of our staff who are doing abuse investigations, as well as those staff in the community that we train. Recently in October, we attended a full-day training with Dr. Sandy Bloom, and we're immersed in the pillars of the Sanctuary model. Sanctuary model is not only trauma-informed care training, but it also looks at agencies and employees to adopt a culture of a trauma-informed approach, recognizing the trauma that the children have experienced, the adverse childhood experiences that they've had, and also recognizing the vicarious trauma that the employees have, and the agency as a whole. So OAPI is absolutely invested in recognizing that and adopting a trauma-informed approach to conducting abuse investigations in the licensed child caring agencies. We are extending our commitment to this approach by having all of our staff go through a training from CARES Northwest. It's actually next Wednesday or Thursday. So all of our investigators for child caring agencies will go through that training. We're also looking at adopting an initial onboarding training around trauma-informed interviewing practices, as well as an annual refresher training for all of our investigators. Now, in addition to conducting abuse investigations, OAPI also trains field offices who do community abuse investigations. We work with the APD community, we work with community developmental disability programs and community mental health programs, and help coordinate the investigations and train their new investigators. So we're also going to infuse this trauma-informed interviewing approach into all of our community investigations as well, and that'll span the population of both children and adults. I guess the last thing that I'll say is that with or without this legislation, we are absolutely committed to adopting a trauma-informed approach to conducting abuse investigations. We think that's going to create a better approach and ultimately make sure that we're coming up with the right conclusions in a more trauma-informed way. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you guys have. Thank you for the opportunity.
Can I ask a quick question?
Quick question. You want to wait till after? In case
well, because I want to come.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Madam Chair. So does this ever overlap to law enforcement? So do you have any connection with law enforcement? Because a lot of times they're kind of in the mix with all of this. Or is this just focused on your agency?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, our abuse investigations certainly do have overlap with law enforcement.
Right.
So if we do, throughout the course of an investigation, hear about a crime or something that needs to be referred to law enforcement, we will make that connection.
And does the training reach there, too?
At this time, OAPI has not made that connection with law enforcement for training.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Morning. Representative Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anna Jean Goins, and I am a program manager for the Office of Child Welfare Programs, Department of Human Services. And one of the things I do is facilitate some of the work that we do in conjunction with Portland State University and our Child Welfare Partnership for training. We have, for the last several years, worked and focused our efforts on infusing trauma-informed practice strategies in all of our training. And where we are in the process right now, we have a specific curriculum on trauma-informed practice strategies that's required for all of our casework staff. But the larger focus of the work has really been a very intentional and focused look at all of the curriculum that and training that we provide for our casework staff, certification staff, so that the revisions in all of that training have a trauma-informed lens to the work. So whether you're doing a child abuse investigation, whether you're visiting a family, when you're working with foster parents, whatever that specific piece of work that you have as an employee of child welfare, the training that we provide, we're working very intentionally to infuse a trauma-informed lens in that work. We've used a lot of the information from the Child Traumatic Stress Network, who has a wealth of information on trauma-informed practices. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, this is way briefer than we wanted it. I know that you were trying to get somewhere by 9:30, so I was trying to squeeze you in here. Yes, we'll have a couple questions and then let you go.
Thank you, Chair Kenninger. This for both of you, as you guys talk about trauma-informed care, there's curriculum out there that are specifically called trauma-informed care, and then it's also kind of a philosophical concept. And so one of the things that this bill does is it spells out seven different points of what this bill thinks should be included in trauma-informed care. Do you guys think that in what you're currently doing that you're covering all those points? And I know that this was specifically intended kind of for OWAPI, and that there are some that feel that they're not always as gentle as they'd like them to be. So do you think you guys cover all that stuff?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Stark, I believe that it will be. CARES Northwest has been so kind as to volunteer to come down and cater a training specifically to OWAPI, the type of investigations that we do. Once we saw the language in the bill, we ran that past CARES Northwest, and I believe the training curriculum for next week is going to cover all of those points in the bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'm going to suspend the work session on 2401. We will come back and vote on the amendments, but we'll let you go because I know you had to be somewhere by 9:30. And I want to open the public hearing on, House Bill 2728. Make sure they get some at least 15 minutes to have this bill heard. And if any of you can stay until 10 of, I know we only meet twice a week and we have a lot of bills. So if there's any way you can kind of make sure you don't schedule meetings right after this in case we have this.
Chair Kenninger, would I be out of order to just move that Representative Hack join our committee?
That'd be truly bipartisan.
There you go.
Yep. Okay. Cassie, can you please read the summary of the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2728 requires Department of Human Services to pay comprehensive service workers at a service rate no less than the rate paid for personal support or direct care workers in secure residential treatment homes or facilities.
Representative Hack.
Chair Kenninger, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to present House Bill 2728 to you. Again, I am Representative Jody Hack. Thank you again. Thank you, Chair, for hearing all of my bills. I really appreciate it. I represent parts of South Salem, Almsville, and Turner. And wage disparity with our DSP workers is just heartbreaking to me. I spent quite a bit of time touring several of our, they're referred to as group homes, but we prefer to call them the people's homes. And just absolutely amazed at the quality of the workforce. These are amazing people that love taking care of our most vulnerable. But when you have conversations with those folks and you hear them say they're having to work two jobs because they're not able to provide for their families, it's heartbreaking. The wage disparity between our state-employed homes versus our private or nonprofit homes is about, on average, about $11 an hour for our private and nonprofit to just under $20 an hour for our state-run homes. When you look at the cost in the contracts for per person allocations, it's $9,000 on the private nonprofit per person for our developmentally disabled folks, and it's $45,000 per person on the state side.
Now, I'm not naive enough to know that there are negotiations that happen, and I also realize that some of that has to do with Medicare and a lot of other formularies and things that are out of some folks' control. However, at the least, those contracts should be negotiated somewhat at the same table so that when there is that large of a wage disparity, some type of a conversation is happening, because over time this has continued to grow and grow and grow. And I was talking with one of the executive directors of Alberta Cur, one of the largest entities that provides these services out of Portland, and he said, you know, the best analogy I can give you is that we've had a low-grade fever for a really long time, and now we have high-grade fever. And they have an enormous lack of a workforce. And he said, you know, it's pretty difficult when I have a staffer who has four children and is homeless. And he said there's only so many Mother Teresa's out there. So we have a huge issue. This has to be addressed. We can't continue to ignore it. These people are taking care of our most vulnerable, and they deserve to be paid a fair wage to do that. These are hard jobs. Mm-hmm. And these ladies are going to talk to you about what that actually looks like. But I wanted to bring this to light. I know in light of our fiscal situation, it's difficult to have this conversation. But at what point are we going to make this a priority? It's going to erupt. We're on the edge of the cliff. And at what point are we not going to have the people to be able to do these jobs? I wouldn't do it for $11 an hour. And I don't know how we expect these folks to do it for $11 an hour. So if I can be a voice for them, I will, and I'll continue to pound this as long as I am here. I know that there's a bill up on the Senate side that asks for 150% of minimum wage, which is great. That's better than nothing. But again, I don't think it's enough. So I'm here on behalf of these folks that do this amazing work. And again, I'll continue to work hard for them and to try to be a voice so that they can be heard and we can continue to bring this issue to the forefront. So thank you for hearing this bill. I really appreciate it.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Vice Chair Stark. My name is Chris Burnett. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Resource Association, and we represent over 60 community providers across Oregon, including Albertina Kerr, PCL, and ASI, who are some of the big agencies that typically take people transitioning out of SACU. These agencies provide 24-hour residential as well as employment and day supports, and the backbone of their work are the direct support professionals. And we support the intent of this bill, and my testimony will detail why it's so important. You've likely seen materials from us that have this logo on it, the state of emergency. We sent it to all legislators. And we took up this campaign a couple of months ago out of desperation because our members were just not able to recruit and retain qualified staff. And they were to the point where they had to say no to referrals, going against their mission as nonprofit service agencies providing Medicaid services. And that's heartbreaking. It just goes against the grain. But if you don't have staff, you can't, you know, keep someone safe and provide adequate supports. So thus, we decided it's time, you know, to really call this an emergency as it is. The impact of the insufficient wages has resulted in an exodus of qualified staff from the community side to not only SACU, but other employment that pays a higher wage and is not quite so complex. New referrals often end up on waiting lists, and you might ask where those people go if there's no supports for them. They can end up in jail, in emergency rooms, homeless on the streets, certainly not where we would want to see those with intellectual and developmental disabilities in Oregon. A recent case about, you know, lack of capacity in the provider system comes to mind. There was a young girl who was a victim of abuse at SACU, and her parents were desperate to get supports for her in their home community in Central Oregon. As much as provider agencies tried to cobble together the right supports for her, they couldn't find the staff, and they couldn't rob from their existing kids programs to do it. So they couldn't help her. So it was a sad case, a heartbreaking case. And what ended up happening is the mother took the girl home, and another provider was able to hire a staff person, and this girl now gets her supports in home. But it was a pretty traumatic case. The high cost of this turnover is crushing to agencies, and Joanne can speak more to that specifically as a provider, but it drains away resources that they would be using to provide supports and services. But beyond the wage, and I have to put this in because it's multi-layered, DSPs need an opportunity for professional advancement. And research shows that training in ethical care and competency in supporting people with difficult behaviors and medical challenges reduces turnover and gives staff a path to stay in the job that they're uniquely qualified for and that they love, and build relationships with staff. So all these things conspire together, and so that's why we're supporting this bill. And in my testimony that you have, I included a link to a video we produced called The Cost of Compassion. I hope you take 7 minutes out of your time to watch it in case you don't really understand what direct support professionals do. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Joanne Furman. I am the co-founder and co-director of Partnerships in Community Living, who are proudly celebrating our 30th year in service this year. And these are some of the hardest times we've ever seen. And today I really appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2728. When it comes to talking about how our rates are developed and how we decide and work on what DSP wages are, it's complicated and sometimes misleading. So we always sort of go back. I think the conversation goes back to what's currently in our rate tool and what a provider's doing with that. And so recently, as we've been trying to dig up on this issue and figure out how do we address this, we've found some things in the rate tool that were things we didn't know. For example, the actual DSP rate that's in the rate tool is a little bit higher than we had anticipated, but the hours that were funded to provide are significantly lower than we anticipated. So there's all these simple things that come out that tell you why we are, why not doing it. And we don't have a lot of time to talk about that today, but I'll tell you it's much more complicated than that. The real issue is focusing on what it takes for us to provide adequate wages for our DSPs. And so it's also important, as we talk about what's in the current rate tool, to remember what an average rate means. So we talked about an average rate of $11 an hour. But as Chris said, we have to have a career track if we want people to stay. People go to these other jobs that pay higher because they also offer them advancement. So in order to do that, whatever we end up deciding on, how we decide what our rates are, it has to provide us room to have an average wage that says we might start people lower, but we also are able to provide people a career opportunity to make more money over time. So those are just sort of logistics of things I kind of wanted to clear the air about. But as a private nonprofit, we're driven by our values. And our values are to create great lives for people that we support. And we cannot do that without a stable workforce, right? Providing good wages and a career track is our number one priority. And I included some charts and things in the information for you to look at that I'm happy to answer any questions you have later. But the crisis we're facing right now is devastating. It's financially devastating for organizations, but more importantly, it puts the people we support at risk. It diminishes their quality of life, and in many cases, it jeopardizes health and safety. So the funding related to how these hours worked and all the things I've just talked about has just made it nearly impossible to retain higher staff, to keep staff. We hire people, we train them well, they love the work, and then they go do what is virtually the same work in another part of our system for $3 to $8 to $7 more an hour. So what happens is we become a training ground, which raises our costs. And people literally have told us that. We came here to get training. We've heard PCL provides great training. we're in the valley mostly, although we have programs in Southern Oregon and Lane County, but that means we're sort of a magnet for that. People come, they get trained, and then they go do this other work and make significantly more money. Not that I begrudge that, because one of our agency values is to create professionals for this field, because I'm passionate about it and people need it. We need great professionals. I'd just like them to have that career working at PCL or an organization like that, doing great work for the people that we're charged to serve. So the idea of creating some parity in the system is really important to me, and is important to the people we support. It's important to our mission and values. It is what makes us a good organization if we keep people. I've shared this before. I shared it yesterday in the bill that Representative Hack talked about, but I want to tell you a little bit about my version of what a DSP is. DSPs are more than caregivers. They support people in all aspects of their life. They're not just there for fun. I know you hear lots of fun things that people do, the movies and all those things, but they're there. They guide people through the most complicated times of their life. They help them figure out these crazy healthcare systems that we have to deal with. They help them figure out how to successfully manage anger and aggression in a way that's safe and healthy for them and safe for people that are around them. They're grief counselors when their family members die and they're left without advocates and people around them. And one of the hardest things that I see, especially with some of our young staff who come and are new, this is some people's newest job, right? They're the ones that are holding people's hands during the end of life and making sure that they end their life with respect and dignity. That is not a minimum wage job. That is a job that deserves a fair and adequate wage, the same wage I'd get doing it somewhere else, just because I'm paid differently or from a different place. So I could go on, and I know you're in a hurry, so I'll skip to the end here. Yesterday during the testimony, we were talking about one of the women we support was testifying, and I'm always learned so much from the people we serve. They give me the best lessons as I try to throw numbers at you. But what she said is, we really need to pay them better so they don't leave me, right? I need my staff not to leave me. And that's a need we all have, right? Good, healthy relationships. We're all healthy, happier, live fuller lives when our support systems stick around and we can count on them and trust them. And in order to provide that for the people we serve, we need your help with bills such as this one. So thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not a question, but just to thank you, Representative Hack, and that the work you're doing, I applaud, because I've had recipients and I've had providers that have done this work, and the recipients are like, I've had to have somebody new coming to me every other week, and it's hard to have continuity, and they're not getting paid enough, or the providers. So I think as our economy changes, that this is a skilled labor job that we actually need to provide for, because you shouldn't be able to get paid at, not that 7-Eleven job's not bad, but you shouldn't be able to get the same pay at a 7-Eleven job that you can for providing this type of work. So, and I want to help you what we can to make sure that we can support your cause and help these people both support themselves and support the programs you guys are providing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much.
Chair Kinnegar, can I just make one comment?
Yep.
I just wanted to say thank you to Angie and Lilia. Angie's the legislative coordinator, and Lilia is the director of Office of Developmental Disability Services. They've been at the table for a lot of the conversations, and Lilia set up a time for me to spend time meeting staff and families and those receiving services. And so I just wanted to, on the record, say thank you for the help that they've also provided.
Wave so people know who you are. Thank you so much. Okay, we have Kendall Mason and Andrea Salinas.
Thanks.
Oops, sorry. Two more.
Yeah. Good morning again.
Hi.
Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark. My name is Kendall Mason, and I am the A policy and political strategist for the Service Employees International Union.
I appreciate the opportunity to share SEIU's perspective on House Bill 2728 and our support for raising wages for direct support professionals. It's clear that the low wages offered to DSPs have made it difficult to attract new workers, and likewise, low wages contribute to the estimated 90% turnover rate among DSPs in the group home sector. The training costs associated with turnover and the high costs resulting from overtime dependence are clearly expensive. However, this bill does not address many of the underlying issues the system supports. The bill attempts to solve the problem of low wages and high turnover of direct support professionals by first comparing them to two different sectors of care, and then by throwing money at an entire industry that has little oversight or transparency. The bill is asking that DSPs not be paid less than two different types of jobs with two different wage scales, both of which have union representation and financial transparency. Group homes are simply not held to the same level of transparency. Direct support professionals work in group homes, providing supports for people living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Personal support workers provide care for similar population of people who are currently living independently or with their families. PSWs are represented by a union, and there is complete financial transparency with the Medicaid dollars that are spent through that particular type of care. Workers at SACU, which is the Stabilization and Crisis Unit, also make livable wages and are represented by a union in a sector of work that also has transparency. The work of a DSP is different than both of these types of supports, and there is currently little transparency in the system of care. In addition, there is no hard evidence that simply increasing the rate for group home providers will result in better pay and lower worker turnover for group homes. For example, I'd like to touch on the 4% increase from 2015 that came with House Bill 5206, which was intended to increase the wages of DSPs. The bill was intended to increase the DSP average wage of $10.80, and it should be noted that both DHS and the providers believed the wage model was at $11.23 when the 4% increase was passed. However, the model was actually based on a DSP wage of $12.94, so that 4% increase then should have led to an average wage of $13.45. Our research department reviewed starting wages posted on Craigslist and provider websites for 33 different group home providers between September 12th and September 23rd of 2016, well after the increase went into effect. Of those job postings reviewed, 14 providers advertised a starting wage well below the 1080 average, and all were below the wage model of $12.94. There is a table included with my testimony that summarizes the research that we did on advertised wages. While 503 supports increasing wages for direct support professionals, we believe that a number of reforms are needed to protect the autonomy and rights of individuals receiving supports and services in these settings. These reforms include requiring that managers explicitly inform individuals that independent living is an option when you're receiving state-funded services, raising penalties for abuse to match the fines levied on other long-term care settings, and enhancing protections for mandatory reporters. We'd like to require annual inspections of group home facilities and require providers to staff according to an individual's support plan rather than minimum staffing ratios that are defined in statute. We hope that these elements will lead to comprehensive reforms in the group home sector, provide more opportunities for independent living, and ensure that both individuals working in this sector and receiving support in this sector are treated with dignity and respect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the contract lobbyist for Oregon AFSCME Local 75. AFSCME represents Local 3213, Albertina Kerr, Coast Rehabilitation, Rainbow Adult Living, and Star of Hope, as well as the Stabilization Crisis Unit, the state-operated group homes that care for people who have no other option for placement. SACU has the highest pay, but those residents also have the highest need. Last June, DHS reported to the Stabilization and Crisis Unit Task Force on client and staff safety that 100% of SACU residents have co-occurring mental health diagnosis. And what that means is that they frequently have multiple diagnoses for both developmental and medical conditions including things like intellectual disabilities with mid-range IQs, autism spectrum and seizure disorders, bipolar and anxiety disorders, intermittent explosive and oppositional defiant personality disorders. So while we believe that, like SEIU, that all workers in this field deserve better pay, and these are very difficult jobs, and that we should be raising the wages for support professionals, and they are all grossly underpaid. But those of SACU employees must also be raised and considered when we look at the bigger picture. And this bill does neglect to do that. And so we must oppose this bill.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for, are there any questions for this committee? Quick comment.
Okay, thank you, Vice Chair. Kendall, I don't see, I thought you referenced your testimony presentation in OLIS.
Yeah.
And I'm not seeing that, so you might want to double check with
the staff. Yeah, I will. I'll make sure. Thanks. Sorry about that.
That'd be great. So you are opening up or actually continuing a conversation that has been going on this issue. We don't have time to delve into it again, but thank you again for highlighting the issue, Representative Hack. And clearly we need to be paying people more. I've heard from personal support professionals who've been on a job for 20 years and making $11.20 an hour, and they're doing the hardest work, and they do it because of their heart. But I've also been in conversations where people say, now the rent has gone up and I'm moving back to Idaho. Or so we absolutely need a lot more of what everyone here has called for. We need much higher wages. I would argue very strongly for bringing wages up and not considering bringing another down in order to do that. This is why this committee is so hard, particularly with our revenue situation as it is. But we are clearly underpaying people for a job that we are, in many cases, undervaluing because of the price that we're putting on it. And we should look into issues of transparency. So making sure that, and I know because I was part of that conversation trying to raise the 4%, there was a constitutional issue with forcing people to pass that all down. And so we wanted that to happen. I think to a large degree, but certainly not entirely, that has happened. But even that was nowhere near enough. And we know that those agencies also, in addition to needing to increase pay, have electricity and rents and things like that that are going up. So we are very underpaying, and I hope this committee will, this is one of the areas, along with child welfare, that we look at making a more significant investment. So I'm going to close the House Bill 2728 and reopen the suspended hearing that I had, work hearing, for the purpose of moving two amendments on. So a work session on 2401. So, Cassie, could you please read the summary and then the two amendments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2401 requires Department of Human Services and Department of Justice to provide trauma-informed training and curriculum, including interview models, symptom recognition, assessment tools, data collection, and methods improving placement stability for case planners and other persons involved in child welfare. We last heard this bill on February 9th. And have the -1 amendments. The -1 amendments removes Department of Justice and enforcement officers from the training process and specifies qualified trainers to provide the training. We also have the -2 amendments, which were uploaded at 8:34. The -2 amendments removes curriculum and inserts training. The -1 amendments have no revenue, and we have not received the fiscal. And the -2 amendments, we have not received the revenue or the fiscal.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 2/13/2017.
Okay, Rep. Stark moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated 2/13/17. Is there any discussion? All right, is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
And Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated.
Oh, you did. I'm sorry. We did it backwards.
-2 amendments dated.
What's today.
The date? 2/16/2017.
All right. Rep. Stark moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendment stated to 1617. Is there any discussion on that?
I'll make a comment on that. I mentioned this earlier on this bill that I had, or there's a few of us that had some concern that there could be some confusion in the industry because there are specific curriculums that are named trauma-informed curriculum, and we're not trying to be that prescriptive to say, go buy this brand name from this company. And so we wanted to open it up, and so by removing the word curriculum and inserting training, the point is the philosophical idea of trauma-informed care is something that that has opened up and can change as the times change and as the best practices change. And so we wanted to broaden that and not be too prescriptive or give the impression that we're trying to be prescriptive.
Exactly. And I want to add to that that, of course, we're very concerned about fiscals. And if it was interpreted that we're going to do this three-hour curriculum training that they have, that maybe that's not appropriate for everyone, the exact three-hour curriculum, and it might cause a huge fiscal to be doing that when they hadn't intended to do it. And if the idea was we're really giving a directive to them that in all the kinds of trainings they do, that they ensure that there's trauma-informed lens on whatever training they're doing, that as they would have other lenses like culturally appropriate or I forget some of the other ones that they talked about, but that would be less of a fiscal. It's more, okay, we have resources for training, but we need to make sure that the trauma-informed lens is applied to everything. It would be taken more as a directive. We hope that will lower the fiscal, and then we'll see if they still interpret this as they need money on top of that to do more training. But we're very aware of doing everything we can to not be as prescriptive and yet actually change the dial and not cost too much money. And so this is where our Dash 2 helps us get to.
And I know you guys are being patient. If I may add one last thing, that I don't know that we clarified. If you read the bill and you're really paying attention, you'll see that this trauma-informed training in this bill is really trying to mandate it for those who are investigating abuse. Okay, and that's very important, especially working with providers, working with families, that sort of thing. And it's a permissive for the other. So it's not a mandate on all the agency. It's if you're going to be investigating abuse, then you better know this stuff when you're going into it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. So. Okay, so with that discussion, is there any further discussion on that Dash 2? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted. And I close the hearing on Human Services and Housing. Thank you again for staying late. You're back, Mike. Back, Mike.